Howdy, everybody, and welcome to another BP Movie Journal, the show I do where I talk about the stuff I've seen since the last time I did one of these. I'm David, just me. Also, I'm lying. I'm not talking about stuff I've seen since the last time I did one of these. I'm talking about... I'm just catching up with where I last left off, which is late February. I'm going to try and get as close to caught up as I can. So let's just jump in and not waste any time. I'm going to kick things off with Thea Sharrock's Wicked Little Letters, which is loosely based on a true story. I should stop doing this, like, when I see a movie that's based on a true story, then look up the true story afterwards and find out how different it is. But it's loosely based on a true story of small town in 1920s England that is rocked by a scandal of dirty letters being sent to women in the town. Olivia Colman plays the upstanding religious spinster is the word. It seems mean, but that's kind of the word. Who is the first victim, and then Jesse Buckley plays the sort of low-class Irish woman whom everyone immediately suspects because of her being low-class and Irish. Thea Sharrock had previously done a romance movie called Me Before You that I quite liked with Emilia Clarke, so I was looking forward to this, and it didn't disappoint. It's a very fun movie, sort of it's not forging any new ground, but very well directed, very well acted, and very charming. Steve McQueen's Occupied City I watched. You already heard me talk at length about this if you listened to the top 10 of my top 10 movies of 2023, because it came in at number 2. But the construction of the movie, just the mixture of images and voice, setting aside everything that I said about what it means, what I'll talk about now is just the unbelievable watchability of it all. He makes it so engrossing, as along with Melanie Hyams is the name of the narrator. It's a movie that's, it's incredibly long, and yet I am looking forward to throwing it on again someday because it's such an enjoyable time. It's engrossing and enthralling. See, here we get to stuff that, like, the minor movies that I watched 3 months ago that I'm like, well, which one was this again? Birth Rebirth is a sort of Frankenstein-ish riff in which Judy Reyes plays a nurse whose daughter dies, and then Maren Ireland plays essentially a mad scientist, but it's, modern day New York City or something like that, who steals the body and then reanimates it. I think there's the movie, I think, is like there's interesting stuff in the text and subtext about, like, these two women co-parenting essentially a zombie. It's really interesting to kind of chew on what the movie is saying about parenting and mothering and sharing duties between women. But unfortunately, the movie never really seems to lift off. Let's see. Rewatched One from the Heart. Well, or I should say that I watched it for the first time in many ways, because I'd only ever seen it once over 20 years ago on VHS. And now this is the reprise, the not only new restoration, but I apparently slightly new edit. I didn't really notice that much, but it's so wonderful. Is it seeing it on a big screen, brand new 4K DCP on a big screen with an audience, the magic of Coppola's not only vision but his execution of that vision is what's so fascinating. I mean, the movie isn't all like Hollywood magic. I guess it feels like a very like, you know, it's a 1981 movie, but it feels like 70s Hollywood, you know, film school brat type of taking over an existing format, much like Scorsese did with New York, New York, and adding layers of messiness that make it feel more modern. But the chemistry between Frederick Forrest and Terry Garr is fantastic. The movie also has a final sequence that is so masterful. Did I already say masterful? In the way that Coppola executes it, that I thought I was gonna faint. So good. Okay. Oh, I love. Everyone was right about this. Matt Johnson's Blackberry is so up my alley. The screenplay is hilarious. The actors are fantastic. The forward momentum of the story, that it hits so many, ostensibly hits like kind of so many of the beats of this type of movie, which we've seen so many of these product origin stories. We've seen so many of, although, I mean, I think the good thing about this one is that unlike, you know, Flamin' Hot or Air, even Air or whatever, it's like, it's more of a rise and fall type of story, not just and here's how we got the great product. There's also like, and here's why it went away. That's a good element to it, but it's got so many of Blackberry is kind of another exhibit in the argument that formula or genre or whatever, tropes become tropes for a reason, and if they can still be wielded with care and a distinguished point of view, they can still be really effective. And also, like I said, it helps movies really funny. It's got fantastic needle drops. It's also very thoroughly Canadian in a way that doesn't it's not just that it is set in Canada about Canadians. It also feels like there's so many I mean, Natalie has accused me of being a Canuckophile, which is I'm fine with saying that. But there is a lot of the sense of Canada being the younger sibling or whatever to the U.S. In so much of Canadian culture, especially the stuff that gets imported here, it just feels like it's made. Knowing or hoping Americans will watch it, Blackberry feels like it is by Canadians for Canadians, and that's kind of why it's so fascinating. It doesn't apologize at any point for Canadian references or Canadian accents or anything like that. Let's move on to Claire Simon's Our Body, a movie that I had missed in theaters back in August, finally caught up with when it showed up on the Criterion Channel. Another very long documentary. I think I've talked about this one on the show too. I think it was in my honorable mentions, I think. But it takes place at it's a very long documentary that takes place at a hospital in Paris and focuses on female patients and everything that might mean, from reproductive care is a big part of it, but breast cancer, all other sorts of things that are, if not female specific, they're leaning female most of the time. So the obvious comparison that a lot of people have made is to Frederick Wiseman. But I think Frederick Wiseman tends to depict the people as an institution as an extension of, or at least gears in the institution. The institution, whatever institution Frederick Wiseman is pointing his camera at, is the subject. And this movie is much more about the women, and the women who are doctors, and men who are doctors too, more than it is about how the hospital functions. So it's the Frederick Wiseman comparisons are obvious, but I think it really is a distinct work. Let's see. Next up, Jesse V. Johnson's Boudica, or Boudica, Queen of War. This is another one that is sort of based on truth, but this is going way back to the year 60 AD, when Rome had control of what is England. And, you know, governed over all of the existing tribes. But Olga Korolenko, whom I really like, plays Boudica, who was a real woman who became the queen of a tribe, but was not recognized because the Romans didn't recognize female leaders. And so she led a... a revolt that ended up burning down London, or Ludinium, or as it would have been called at the time. A couple of reasons I chose to watch this one. Natalie and I had just visited London last October, and had heard the story of Queen Boudica from a couple of different tour guides in our walking tour. So the story was fresh in my mind, and I realized, oh, there's been multiple movies about her, but I was like, oh, there's a new movie. Also, Jesse V. Johnson had directed, is it called Hell Hath No Fury? He directed a sort of World War II actioner a year or two ago that really held my attention and really made me want to pay attention to him. So I don't think it's as good as Hell Hath No Fury, partially because that movie is so, like, has such a small focus, you know, on just a handful of characters kind of in a standoff in a cemetery for most of the movie. This one is obviously very larger in scope, and I think because of that, maybe some of Johnson's character as a director gets set aside because he's just going so large with it. But it's still definitely worth watching. I also now... for as long as Apple says I do, I own the digital copy because I accidentally hit buy instead of rent. maybe I'll watch it again. All right. Next up is a double feature of Ralph Bakshi movies. I have known who Ralph Bakshi is, but I'd never actually seen any of his movies, and the New Beverly did a double feature, starting with 1975's Coonskin, which that is the name of the movie. It is not a coincidence that there is a word that has been used as a racial slur in it. It is completely about black characters and completely about them just taking it all the way back to white America. And the movie is so lively but also grimy, but like it, like a lot of what I understand Ralph Bakshi to be very overtly sexual. America is personified by this white blonde woman in incredibly tight clothing with enormous breasts and visible nipples poking through her tight shirt, but she also mocks and abuses and uses the black characters, but they're not here to take it. The movie is definitely it comes off as kind of a revenge fantasy, and I was very into it. Yes, it is weird that this movie and the next movie in some ways are made by a white guy, but I guess, as they say in documentaries, it was the 70s. And then next up is Heavy Traffic by Ralph Bakshi, which is also great, and is, I think, a little bit more autobiographical, and it's a story of a wannabe an aspiring cartoonist kid who kind of falls in with unsavory characters. But this isn't the kind of movie that's like, uh-oh, it's like, fuck yeah, these are awesomely unsavory characters. This also has a lot to do with people of the same economic class but different racial backgrounds coexisting in ways that feel very uncomfortable to today's standards, but provide a sort of fascinating window into Ralph Bakshi's time and place. Not that, I mean, the guy's still alive, but I mean his time and place as a young man, like the one that he's making the movie about. Okay. Next up, I'm not going to talk too long about this. It's directed by Kaveri Kaul. It's a documentary from 1991 called One Hand Don't Clap, which is a movie about calypso music. And it's full of good music and is worth watching kind of because of that and because I don't know much about calypso. But I don't really have much else to say about it. But yeah, it is full of great music. If you're going to make a documentary about music, make sure that the music is in the documentary. Don't constantly have people talking over the performances. Okay, next up, a movie that I watched because I'm a big fan of the director. Not as a director, but as a comedian and writer and actor, making her directorial debut, Chelsea Peretti, directed a movie called First Time Female Director, which is about a playwright who gets promoted to directing her own play because the sort of house director at this like small theater gets Me Too'd, and they want a woman to take over because it looks good. And so the movie is very clear about how she ended up with the job, and she's aware of it, but she's not going to stop her from trying to make the most of it. But she's also very, neurotic in her own way. The movie is the movie's funny. It's not that well made. It looks cheap, and it looks like someone who hasn't really overthought too much where to put the camera. Certainly hasn't spent a lot of time thinking about lighting. All right, so let's move on to Suzanne Reyes' Close to Vermeer, a documentary that's about Johannes Vermeer. It takes as its sort of framing or structural, its skeleton, if you will, its backbone, the mounting of a Vermeer show in Amsterdam, which is the largest collection of his works in one place ever. But it's... unlike, you know, saying one hand don't clap is a good way to learn about Calypso, this is a good way to learn about Vermeer. But Reyes has more on her mind, which is more about considering how we look at art. Like, I don't mean how we think of art. I mean literally how we take it in, in the context around, you know, mounting a show, you know, contextualizing each painting among all the other paintings, and then also, like, what do you know? You know, there's a lot of, it gets into a lot of the same stuff that the documentary Tim's Vermeer got into years back. About how, like, speculating about how Vermeer made his paintings, but we don't know. And does knowing affect how you look, or does knowing there's a debate affect how you look? Are you looking for something? It's a really fascinating documentary focused on people who are obsessed with art, and that's what's that's what I really take away, not the stuff about Johannes Vermeer himself. Next up, I got to go and see in a theater on 16mm film Michael Snow's La Région Centrale, which I had not seen when we did our Michael Snow profile episode, and I'm so glad that I waited to see it for the first time in a theatrical setting. If you don't know what the movie is, it's a 3-hour, I think, a little over 3-hour movie for which Michael Snow had a specific camera arm and machine built that he could control remotely that would swing the camera in all different directions, up, down, sideways, in circles. And he could control it, and it's just 3 hours of looking at this. It's in one place, on the top of way up in the mountains, like looking at these mountains in Quebec, I think, is where he did it. And it's overpowering at times, especially seeing it on a big screen and seeing some of these big tilts, and then there are parts when the, you know, he makes you wait for it, but eventually the camera goes fucking crazy, and it's awesome to see it in a big to see it. It becomes dizzying and overwhelming when you're seeing it big. There's also a lot of slow parts of the camera moving very, very slowly, and it's interesting seeing it on part of the reason that, like, I think a lot of people like film, and seeing things on film is because it has a life and a patina, and so there were definitely times when I was watching the scratches on the film move across the sky, which of course Michael Snow could never have intended, but that's part of the experience now for me in particular, because that's how I saw it. Really glad I waited to see that in a theater. Now let's move on to a new-ish documentary called The Tuba Thieves, which is not about tubas or theft. I mean, it kind of is. It kind of weirdly, like, dovetails. Sorry. with the last repair shop, and then it's about musical instruments being stolen from schools, which that really happened. The real focus of this movie is an experiment in sound. And there are multiple deaf characters, including the director, who appears here, making, and the director is trying to kind of approximate, like, shaking up how you hear the world, kind of taking it apart. You're hearing, you're hearing only what she wants you to hear, which is sometimes very little at all, sometimes just one thing, but not the main thing. And there's also, as with like something like Sound of Metal, the closed captions are actually part of the movie. In this case, though, they're the most sort of like poetic closed captions. Normally, closed captions are very straightforward, you know, like car, like tires on gravel or something like that. But she'll write about, or I'm assuming she wrote them, but the captions here will sort of describe things kind of musically and kind of like the, like, I wish I had my notes in front of me because it's been a while, obviously, since I watched this, but I wrote down some examples that I don't have in front of me. But describing the wind as if it's music and the rustling of grass and things you wouldn't necessarily have described so poetically. Let's see. Moving on, this is shameless because this is a friend of the, multiple friends of the show made this movie, but friend of the show, Matt Warren, his directorial debut is a horror movie called Delicate Arch, produced by friend of the show, Josh Long, and Natalie and I got to go see it, and turns out it's really good and really, it's funny, but in a, because it's like, I guess it would fall under like meta, but it's not not in a Scream like tongue-in-cheek way. It's more like in an existential, like, why are we here, what are we doing type of way, but also still funny. So yeah, I liked it, and it's cool, and it definitely gets scary too. Moving on, Immaculate. I finally joined the, well, I guess I finally had my chance to join the Cult of Sydney Sweeney. This is not the movie to do it. Immaculate is a very derivative movie. It's Rosemary's Baby in a convent. And it doesn't really say anything new. It does have a really cool ending that, people have rightfully pointed out. But I can't really recommend it.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable.
Let's see. Minhal Begg's We Grown Now, I saw, which is a coming of age story set in the early 90s in the Cabrini Green housing project in Chicago, which is not there anymore, but is, I guess, to, you know, people who know it from Chicago, it was known for like a lot of these, a lot of housing projects ended up, you know, falling victim to crime because they weren't they were not planned with a lot of foresight, and of course they're home mostly to poor people of color, who of course then get ignored and or over policed and live in poverty, and poverty breeds crime. It's just we all know how poverty and crime work. But Cabrini Green is also the setting of Candyman, around the same time. Candyman does not make an appearance in the movie, at least not on screen. Maybe he's there metaphysically. Yeah, it's pretty standard coming of age stuff, I guess, in many ways. It's about two boys who are friends and have different family lives and end up getting sort of growing apart because they have different choices offered to them. Yeah, it's well made, but not really revelatory. Let's move on to a movie directed by Shusuke Kaneko. It's called Summer Vacation 1999, but the movie came out in 1988, so it is technically in the future, and it's awesome. It's a Japanese movie about, it, weirdly kind of similar to The Holdovers in the sense that it's about students at a boarding school while class is not in session. It's over the summer, but in this case, there don't seem to be any adults. There's just like, there's four kids, and then one of them, right at the beginning of the movie, one of them dies, and then a new student arrives. He's early while waiting for the school year to begin. He shows up, he's early, and he is played by the same actor as the kid who died and looks exactly like him, and everyone can't, the other three characters can't stop talking about how he looks exactly like him. But he doesn't act at all like him, and is mostly kind of annoyed by all the attention. It gets to strange metaphysical places, and it's really, really fucking cool. Summer Vacation 1999. Really liked it. Let's see, what else to do? Housekeeping for Beginners is a movie that I was looking forward to because Goran Strzelecki made You Won't Be Alone, which is not a great movie, but is a really fascinating movie in the mechanisms by which its story is told. The sort of like shifting protagonist, but it's all one protagonist at the same time. Anyway, that's not the movie we're talking about. We're talking about Housekeeping for Beginners. But I had been intrigued enough by You Won't Be Alone that I was really looking forward to Housekeeping for Beginners. And it's not bad. It's definitely got... He's got a good sense for naturalism among, like, in ensemble, like, in group scenes. It's basically about a woman, a gay woman, who lives with a gay man. But also at the beginning of the movie has a romantic partner who has children, and then that partner dies, and so she keeps a promise to her dead girlfriend to raise her kids. But she also like uses her home, like she welcomes a lot of like stray homeless queer kids or other sort of outcast kids into her home. So there's this kind of like found family type of thing. I can't say that the story is the reason to watch this movie. I think the characters and the actors embodying them bring a lot to it, and yeah, his sort of naturalistic but urgent filmmaking. It's definitely interesting. I don't think it's as good as I had hoped it would be, but it's definitely an interesting movie. Let's see. Now we are, and we are really catching up because now I'm into Los Angeles Festival of Movies. And then I watched, oh man, an amazing short film by Elan René. We're going to get to more of those because I watched five of them, but not all in a row. But this first one I watched is the best one. It's called La Chante du Styrene, or The Song of Styrene, and it's about plastic and like plastic, like processed plastic molding and stuff. And it's kind of a fun like celebration of plastic, but it's also a celebration or a look at the like process of molding plastic and the machinery at work, and it's kind of this like anti-human but in a fun way short film. I really loved it. You've already heard me talk about Civil War at length, so yeah, Alex Garland's Civil War is next. I didn't like it. I think that like it's too winking and knowing, and it's like we're not telling you what side is what. Like there's a way to do that that isn't so pleased with itself, and that might actually be able to just say something. But fantastic needle drops. So who knows? Maybe we'll be talking about it with Scott and Sean early next year. All right, next up, a documentary called Igualada about a black woman in Colombia running for president. The term Igualada is meant to be like an insult to like to mock like lower class people who want to quote unquote like put on airs and act like they're of a higher class, God forbid. And so there's an irony to this like woman from a lower class background who is also black and faces a lot of racism in Colombia for that, being, you know, the movie calling itself that about her. Yeah, like, yes, I am going to move up through the ranks. And so yeah, it's a great movie about a great documentary about democracy and the strength to stand up. All right, back to The New Beverly for another double feature. This one's Marlon Brando double feature, On the Waterfront, which is not a first time watch for me. I've seen On the Waterfront before, and it's terrific as it always was. Marlon Brando playing a dumb guy without any apologies or like you know, any nods to the audience to say like, I'm a smart guy playing a dumb guy, don't worry. No, he's just playing a dumb guy. The movie is rousing, but also very funny. Surprisingly, that's one thing I didn't remember, is it being so funny. And then that followed up with The Wild Ones, directed by Laszlo Benedek, which Brando's like, you can't look away from in this movie, but the rest of the movie is very stupid. It's just a stupid, like, oh, these ruffians are running wild in this small town, which is not a small town. It's clearly a backlot. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Went to the Los Feliz 3, American Cinematheque at the Los Feliz 3 to see a really amazing movie called Not a Pretty Picture, directed by Martha Coolidge, who would go on to make things like Valley Girl and Real Genius. But this is not a comedy like she is known for. This is basically Martha Coolidge makes a short film about her own experience being raped as a teenager. She casts as herself a young woman who was also raped, and then makes a documentary about her making this short film. So we go kind of back and forth between like reliving the events of the night, but then also seeing Martha Coolidge talk with the actors about the events. It's incredibly fascinating and incredibly humanist in the way that it refuses to look away from these characters while also refusing to treat either Coolidge or the woman she cast as herself, or the younger version of herself who is the character that woman is playing, as merely victims. It's way more complex than that. They're humans and they have been victimized, but the movie is not interested in reducing them to their victimhood. But also it's really revealing about, you know, the guy who plays her rapist, that actor, there's a lot of talk with him, and it's really fascinating to see how the understanding of rape from on the point of view of from the point of view of men has evolved. That, you know, this guy's like a decent dude, but also like just casually says things that are shocking by today's standards. But of course, I'm not judging the movie by today's standards. I'm saying it's a great movie and that you should see it, but also you should prepare yourself. It's not light viewing. Back to Alain René's short films. Paul Gauguin is a short documentary about Paul Gauguin. I learned some stuff. It's not the most formally daring movie of Alain René's career. It feels like you could show it in art class. Then he also directed a short called Guernica about Picasso's Guernica painting that is both about the painting and the context of the Spanish Civil War and what the painting is about. Again, very educational, but also a little more artful, maybe, than the Paul Gauguin one. Okay, back to crazy 80s Japanese movies. 1985's Bumpkin Soup. It has other titles, but the current restoration and American re-release is called Bumpkin Soup. It's directed by Kiyoshi Kurosawa, who had gone to great acclaim. It's a girl, really, like a college girl. Maybe she's not even in college yet. She visits a college because she's gonna go to school there. I'm already forgetting the premise, but the fine points, the particulars, they escape me. But what's really important is that she goes to this school and everyone is like naked and fucking all the time, and her shyness is kind of on trial here. Is she right? Is she prude? But it also feels like Kiyoshi Kurosawa just like throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall in the best way. It's got a lot of you know, sort of philosophical and political sloganeering in it, in a way that kind of reminded me of some of the more didactic films of the French New Wave and Godard and stuff like that. And then I followed that up with 1984's The Crazy Family, directed by Gakureyo Ishii. This one's a more straightforward narrative than Bumpkin Soup, but it's not really any less crazy. Yeah, the title is not lying. It's a man has just been able to get his family out of public housing and into their first ever home, but he is aware, or at least maybe he imagines, because perhaps he is delusional himself, that there is a sort of mental sickness in his family, that comes to bear. But it's also, I mean, there is a question of like, are they all nuts or is he nuts and he drives them nuts? And then the grandfather comes to stay with them, and the movie's very funny, very stressful, and very loud and weird, of just this, yeah, a family going crazy. Oh wow, we are really, we might catch up, you guys. We might actually catch up. So yeah, because now we're at just a couple weeks ago. saw Vera Drew's The People's Joker. This is so my shit. I love a movie that uses its own low budget to great effect. This is a movie that is like, so there's so much live action mixed with animation or computer generated augmented things, whatever they are, made by different artists. The credits are a blast just looking at all the different artists and the different tasks they had to imagine different parts of Gotham City. But it feels like this is the new new wave, the new handmade type of film is done with computer software. There are parts of I Saw the TV Low that also get at the same itch to me. There's like it looks very intentionally, it looks very kind of like ugly and clunky in a way that is very now. It's not using computer generated effects to stand in for real life. It is using them as an end in themselves. And some of them are fantastic looking, and some of them are very cheap looking, and they're all great. The movie itself is quite funny and has a lot to say. And you also got Maria Bamford voicing Lorne Michaels. so that's pretty great. Let's move on to another Alain René. So what is this, 4 of the 5? This is Tout le mémoire du monde, or All the World's Memory, which is a very dramatic and exciting documentary about a library. I love this. It's a short documentary about a library, but it has all of these like extreme angles and close-ups and push-ins and dramatic music. It makes a library seem almost as awesome as it actually is. Next up, Mark Levin's Slam, an independent feature from the late 90s that I remember when this came out, and I never saw it, but it's about a young, I guess, I don't know if he's a slam poet, but you'll be surprised to learn that that doesn't pay the bills. So he also sells drugs, and he ends up going to prison, and through that meets a volunteer, sort of art therapy volunteer, played by Sonia Sohn, who also wrote the movie, or co-wrote the movie with Saul Williams, the lead. And they kind of inspire each other and form this volatile relationship. It's another film. I think the filmmaking is, as with like House of Gaskin for Beginners, I think the filmmaking is more the draw to me than the screenplay. That there's it has a docudrama type of feel to it, and Mark Levin has a willingness to let his actors clearly improvise and let scenes go on in ways that produce things that are interesting. Next up, Back to the New Beverly for another double feature. This one's a Gloria Graham double feature of two movies I had not seen. One of them was and will always be Nicholas Ray's In a Lonely Place, which is a fascinating movie. It's Humphrey Bogart stars in it, and it's Bogart in a way you've never quite seen him before. I mean, we've seen him as the sort of like a jaded wisecracking cynic like Rick in Casablanca, and so that's definitely what he is here. So we have seen him in that, but he also ends up going to places with being unhinged in ways that come out gradually over the course of the movie. So that's fascinating, but it's also, it really, as by the time he gets to the end, it really sort of becomes Gloria Graham's picture. This is the second time I'll mention New York, New York, but that's another, it feels very similar in the sense that it's like, it starts off from De Niro's character's point of view, and you like, oh, is he gonna get the girl? And then like it slowly transfers to Liza Minnelli, or in this case Gloria Graham's point of view, where you're like, oh, I hope he doesn't get her. I hope she doesn't let herself be gotten by him. I hope she gets away. But it's not as simple as that, because their chemistry is fantastic, and the way that they we see their love for one another. It's really a beautiful movie. It's a doomed, dark love story. I mean, it's also like a fascinating screenplay in the sense that, like, I'm sorry, let's see who, Edmund H. North, Andrew Salt are the credited screenwriters. And that the premise is that, like, we know from the openings, the sort of like, prologue of the movie, there's a murder. We know that Humphrey Bogart's character did not commit this murder, and that he meets Gloria Graham because she's a witness who is able to provide evidence that helps prove that he did not commit the murder. And yet the more she gets to know him, the more she starts to wonder if maybe he did commit this murder, even though we know he didn't. Fascinating movie. Very beautiful. Very sad. And yeah, Gloria Graham, she's just, I mean, I guess because she died, we can like try to overlook the Woody Allen-ness of her, which is that, yes, her fourth and final husband was her former stepson. It's weird. Anyway, she's also in Fritz Lang's The Big Heat. She's not really the lead there, but she's a pretty high build and a lot of screen time character. Glenn Ford, this is The Big Heat is detective noir, where Glenn Ford plays a detective who sort of falls ass backwards into some information that he clearly wasn't supposed to learn, and as a result ends up investigating people that he's not supposed to investigate. There's corruption at high levels. His fellow officers and the officers to whom he's, the policeman to whom he reports, want him to stop, but he's got, you know, Glenn Ford plays, you know, he's tougher in here than he is in, you know, Superman or Blackboard Jungle or whatever, but he's still got that, like, he's too good. He's too good of a person to let this go. And Gloria Graham plays the girlfriend, I guess, of Lee Marvin's character, who's a local hood who works for the crime syndicate, and Gloria Graham ends up helping Glenn Ford solve the mystery. So yeah, it's a cool mystery story, very tight. It's, yeah, not even 90 minutes long. It's there's a bunch of incident in it, but it moves super fast. It's a super tight, engaging mystery, and one that is not without its violence. Fifth and final on Alain René short, 1948's Van Gogh, which is it's a 20-minute documentary about the life of Vincent Van Gogh. There's narration and there are close-ups of his paintings, and that's all you see for 20 minutes in black and white, which is interesting because Van Gogh is so, to me, so associated with color that it's very interesting to see the brush strokes and the paint clumps in black and white, to see them in a new context. But yeah, that's the last one of those. And then, well, yeah, we're at the end. So, there's two more, and then, yeah, I have a third thing that I saw, but I'm embargoed. I'm under embargo. I forgot about that. I'm supposed to brag about it. I'm under embargo. So, I went back to the New Beverly for another double feature. This one is a Wolfgang Peterson double feature. One movie that I had never seen, and one movie that I have seen many, many times. The one I'd never seen before is Air Force One. And yeah, it's, a lot of fun. I mean, it's you know, we had a decade of like Die Hard ripoffs, and this is Die Hard on a plane, which we already had with like Passenger 57, but it's Die Hard on a plane except John McClane is also the president. It's terrifically fun. There's one, you know, I was like, the whole movie's on a plane, like how much variation could there be? But there are so many set pieces that are so fun. The movie looks, it's an expensive special effects extravaganza. And yeah, Gary Oldman as the lead hijacker is really great, like really chewing the scenery in the best way, and really creating a character that you understand. You don't necessarily say, oh, I approve of what he's doing, killing these people, but you come to understand him and understand what drives him. Yeah, I mean, Harrison Ford is Harrison Ford. He's great. The movie's got a great supporting cast, including Xander Berkeley, whom I've always loved. But to me, Gary Oldman is the linchpin. He's the highlight of the movie. And then I will end with a movie that it was a favorite of mine as a kid because I was a normal teenage boy. Of course, I loved Wolfgang Peterson's In the Line of Fire. But yeah, movie I've seen many, many times, but not for a long time, and only ever on VHS with, you know, just me and my dad or whatever. I had never seen it in a theater on film the way this is. And yeah, maybe some of the screenplay stuff as far as like the mystery and the detective sort of story of it all. You know, it's a cat and mouse movie. John Malkovich plays someone who has a very clearly stated attempt or intent to assassinate the president. And Clint Eastwood plays an aging Secret Service agent who was one of Kennedy's Secret Service agents. And so he's got this like past where he's like blames himself for Kennedy dying, and now he's got a chance maybe to redeem himself by saving this president. It's a little ridiculous, and yeah, a lot of the cat and mouse detective story plot mechanics are maybe a little clunkier than I realized when I was, you know, 12 or whatever and watching this movie. But it's still a real like brawny but prestige-y big budget studio picture from the 90s, and Wolfgang Peterson, it's just shocking some of the stuff, like some of the like the location shooting and the amount of extras, because the president, who is not even really a main character, he's almost like a MacGuffin in the movie, but he's running for re-election, and the amount of money it's been, like, yeah, let's go to Denver, get like 5,000 extras for this political rally for a scene that lasts all of 45 seconds. It's insane. And there's multiple things like that in the movie. Score by Ennio Morricone. What's really fascinating to me, I guess, is, well, apart from the fact that like so much of the movie is about how old Clint Eastwood is, and this is over 30 years ago and he's still out there, but the dynamic between Malkovich and Clint Eastwood is kind of hilarious to me, in that Malkovich is, his character is written and he is playing the character as this great adversary, this great, like, unhinged genius of a diabolical madman with the singular goal. He's not, like, assassinating the president because of some policy dispute. He's assassinating the president because he's obsessed with presidential assassinations and he wants to go down in history as one of the presidential assassins. Meanwhile, Clint Eastwood is playing his guy as this kind of, like, shallow thinker, you know, guy who thinks and acts with his gut and has no time for any of Malkovich's existential bullshit musings. As fun as they are to listen to and as great as they are being delivered by John Malkovich, it's like, it's repeatedly hilarious that Malkovich will go on one of these rants about destiny and fate and this sort of soft, thoughtful, but creepy voice, and then Clint Eastwood over the phone will respond with something along the lines of like eat my ass, motherfucker, or something, just like the most base thing. And his continued refusal to take Malkovich's bullshit, like he's never like, oh, this guy, you know, this guy is a worthy adversary. He's just like, this motherfucker, I'm going to get him. it's fun and funny and, absolutely holds up.